This is the Medic Cast, January 17th, 2011.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show this week. We have a lot coming up in this episode, including a review of stroke care in the pre-hospital setting. So we'll be reviewing that here in a little bit in the tip of the week after we hit on the listener mail and the news. So stick around for that. In the meantime, I do want to welcome all the brand new listeners and viewers of the show. There's a lot of people viewing the episodes now, available over at medicast.tv, also on set-top boxes like the Roku box, and soon to be available in places like Boxy and Google TV, hopefully here in the next 6 months or so. So there'll be lots of different ways you can watch the Medicast. Of course, don't forget, the audio version of this show is always available. So if you're looking for something that's less of a high download and you like watching the show sometimes, but you want to take it with you more portably, you can definitely still get the MP3 version of the episodes via places like iTunes. And so just look for the audio version, the original version of the Medicast. And for a lot of you, that's the kind you kind of grew up with here. So it's great to have you all here on the show. And if you haven't checked out the video version of the show, you can do that again over at medicast.tv. Of course, the Medicast website is there for all of the follow-up resources and the show notes for this and every other episode. Head over to medicast.com/blog, click on the show notes link at the top of the page, and just go ahead and check out the episode's information, the links to the news items, and additional resource links for any of the tips or interviews that have happened in that episode, all available over at the Medicast website, as well as the additional articles and information posted there throughout the course of the week. If you'd like to get back in touch with me, you can certainly send an email in. Shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com, podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. So if you're listening to the show and you have something that you just have to comment on, go ahead and send that comment in. Call in on the voicemail line and share your thoughts or ideas with the listeners here on the Medicast. Let's jump on in and also remind you that there is information available for you over at the Medicast fan page on Facebook. Facebook.com/Medicast is your resource over there. Just click the like button at the top of the page to become a fan over there. And there's additional links, sometimes videos and other segments that get posted there either before or in addition to what's posted at the Medicast blog. So you'll find additional resources and information, as well as the community of over 2,000 followers over there, over on the Facebook fan page. Also, don't forget you can find me personally on Twitter and Facebook, twitter.com/podmedic and facebook.com/podmedic. And don't forget all the great shows available for you over at the ProMed Network at promednetwork.com, where you can find great programs like the Mitigation Journal from Rick Rosati, Chris Montero's great stable of shows, the EMS Garage, EMS Leadership Podcast, Greg Fries's EMS Educast, First Few Moments, and I mean, there's just too many to even go over here. Jim Huffman has a great series of shows over there from his EMS safety stuff, so definitely follow up on the ProMed Network and find some of the other great EMS programs available for you over there. Let's jump on into this week's listener mail, and we got a bunch of listener emails in, so I want to go ahead and jump on those right away. First off, I got an email from a listener, Julia, who is training as a dispatcher and wanted me to go over and do some information on dispatching and EMS. So we're going to try to find some information that we can put together as a tip of the week and a review item. And heck, I'm going to contact Julia back. Maybe, Julia, you'd be interested in coming on and talking about that side of things, talking a little bit about dispatching and how that affects you. We can maybe have a little bit of a discussion about dispatching. It's so often we take for granted the information we get, and that, you know, we roll our eyes because sometimes the dispatchers get it wrong. Well, maybe they don't get it wrong. Maybe the dispatchers just the patients aren't giving them the information that they need, or they're giving them incorrect information. So it's important for us to understand what's going on in the whole process. And that process most often starts with a call to 911 and a discussion with one of our dispatchers. So I'm hoping to have some follow-up. And Julia, thanks for reminding me about that. And I hope you're having a good new year as you move into doing more dispatch work and learning more about what's going on there. We also have I got an email in from Tom Boothelet over at the pre-hospital ECG 12 lead blog, or 12 lead ECG blog. You can find Tom's blog, search for it, and Tom just has a great set of resources. He and I were following some of the coverage of the Consumer Electronics Show because there was a lot of healthcare-related gadgets and electronics on view there. And Carissa O'Brien was there. A lot of you know Carissa from our coverage of conferences. She's one of our hosts for our short video segments. Carissa also has the Baseline Vitals blog. And Carissa was at CES and did some coverage and some video segments for the Tech Podcast Network while she was there. And Tom and I were following her coverage and some of the other things. And Tom brought up that there are some great iPhone apps. Dr. Dave Albert has an iPhone ECG app that helps reading ECGs, and there are just a lot of good healthcare apps and gadgets out there. So we'll review them periodically here on the show and talk about some things as they come up, but maybe you have one that you found that really makes a difference in your patient care and how things go for you as an EMT or paramedic. So why don't you let me know about that? Send those emails in and tell me what your favorite EMS gadget is. And it's great to hear from Tom. Hopefully we're going to see Tom here coming up soon at EMS Today. Speaking of EMS Today, I've been talking with Carissa O'Brien about EMS Today, and we finally have gotten things announced or finalized to the point that we can say, hey, we're going to be podcasting live at EMS Today in a podcast booth there. So if you're going to be coming to Baltimore here in March, coming up, I think March 1st through the 5th is the full conference. I think the exhibit hall opens late on the 3rd, I believe. So check it out. And visit Baltimore. Come down to EMS Today. If you haven't been to one of these conferences, you should definitely do so because there's just a ton of great information, educational opportunities, continuing education, both in the conference at large, as well as education going on throughout the exhibit hall in places like the physio control booth and other places. So you can get a lot of good follow-up information and education, as well as see what's new in the EMS sector. And we're going to be covering it as well with live videos and live programs from the exhibit hall floor, recording episodes of the MedicCast, the EMS Garage. We're going to have Rick Rosati there from the Mitigation Journal. Natalie Quibido is coming in along with some of the gang from the GenMed show. All of these are going to be happening, and a lot of other ProMed people will be there. So we're going to have the ProMed network there in full force with the support of EMS Today and GEMS. And we want to thank all those folks for inviting us to come back and working with us to make sure that we can be there and cover this event for you, those of you that can't make it. But if you're going to be there, definitely come by, stop by the booth and say hello, meet us, shake our hands, wait and listen to some of the shows. We're going to have a seating area so you can come, get a bite to eat, come back to the podcast booth, sit down and listen to the show that's going on while you have your lunch, and enjoy the conference when you come and follow up on the information. Maybe we will see some things that you didn't, so we'll have definitely a lot of follow-up information for you after the conference as we release the programs we recorded there. So Carissa, thanks for helping out with that, and she's my right-hand person with helping to get these things organized, and we're looking forward to the conference just over a month away in the beginning of March. So we'll see you in Baltimore in 2011 at EMS Today. That's it for the listener mail. If you want to get in touch with me again, podmedic@mac.com for emails, and send in those voicemails as well, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and check in with us here and let me know what you want to see more of, maybe make corrections that I've made a mistake about, whatever the case may be. I love to hear from you, and I try to get back to each and every one of you when you send me emails and comments in. So keep them coming. Time now to jump on into this week's news, and let's start off with a look at some news out of New York City. We're following their recent snowstorm and blizzard that they had up there. And there were a lot of complications, as is expected when you dump a lot of snow in a city environment where they just don't have anywhere to put all of it. And of course, when there's inclement weather, it causes delays in care and services, such as ambulance response. So is it really our fault or our EMS chief's fault when we can't get to the patients physically? We had this discussion about Pittsburgh last year. Last year, during that multiple 4-foot blizzards that we got back to back in the East Coast, the city of Pittsburgh ended up disciplining and firing 2 paramedics because they weren't going to walk a distance from their ambulance after the policy was that patients had to come to them when they got their ambulances stuck. So we certainly are using EMS as a scapegoat. And, you know, it's nice to see the trend is continuing because New York fired the EMS chief following problems with EMS response and ambulances not being able to get to patients and not being enough coverage during the recent snowstorm in New York. Now, you know, I noticed as I was following this story and seeing what was going on that, you know, they didn't fire the director of the Public Works Department, who's in charge of plowing the snow. The fire chief didn't get fired. They fired the EMS chief because, for some reason, his ambulance personnel are supposed to put plows in the front of their ambulances and do the job of the Public Works Department. The fire department couldn't come out with shovels and help dig them through to the patient. So apparently the EMS service is supposed to take care of all this by themselves. And it makes a convenient scapegoat for the fire services and the city officials to have this political person that they can just throw under the bus whenever a problem comes along associated with ambulance care and bad weather. It doesn't have anything to do with poor planning at the highest levels of emergency response. It has to do with the fact that the poor EMS people couldn't get their jobs done because nobody else was giving them the support they needed. Can you tell I feel a little strongly about this? This is just yet another situation where EMS gets sacrificed for the purposes of political expediency so that the mayor and the rest of the people can look better because they didn't get the job done that should have been done. Let's face it, the ambulances shouldn't be punished and the EMS chief shouldn't be punished when his ambulances can't get to patients and patients die because the snowplows aren't there to plow them in. So, you know what? That's just the way it goes. So we're not going to punish the sanitation or the public works department. We're not going to punish the fire department for not providing additional support to the ambulance units. We're going to go ahead and throw EMS under the bus. Okay, that's the way it is. It was the nature of our business, and eventually, you know, the EMS system is going to break so severely that they're going to have to completely revamp how we do things. And one of the best things that can happen to us in EMS is to get us the heck away from being part of a fire department. Because ultimately, we end up being second-class citizens and are treated as not as important as the guys who sit around all day waiting for 1 or 2 or 3 alarms while the ambulance crew runs 10 or 12 and the fire department somehow thinks that they're entitled to have that kind of restful job. So, okay, enough. Send your emails in to podmedic@mac.com because I'm sure I'm going to hear back from some of you that are fire department members listening to this. Give me a piece of your mind, and I probably deserve it in some respects, but come on now. We're going to fire the EMS chief in New York because patients died during a snowstorm when the roads couldn't get plowed because Public Works wasn't prepared? Come on. You got to admit, you may not agree with me about fire departments and EMS in general, but you gotta agree that this was just a political move to save face and had nothing to do with whether EMS was actually responsible for any of these bad outcomes. All right, enough. I'm stepping down from the soapbox now. Let's go ahead and move on into talking about winter in general. You know, there's a great article out of the Dayton, Ohio, the Dayton Daily News website, and it's about winter injuries and safe sledding. You know, I talk about prevention and education of our communities all the time here on the MedicCast. I talk about it over on the nursing show. What can we do to educate our communities so that we make our jobs easier in the long run? Talking about seasonal problems that are commonly occurring, how many times do we have sledding-related injuries, people who get injured while doing things that they probably shouldn't be doing, right? sometimes it's just a question of saying, hey, you know, just remember, this might be a bad idea, okay? Now, yeah, they should probably know that themselves, and heck, if it wasn't for all the idiots out there, we wouldn't have a job, because let's face it, how many times do we go out on calls where we wouldn't be out there if somebody hadn't made some kind of a mistake? But regardless of the fact that that is the case, we should be doing some things to prevent injuries, especially in kids. And this is what we're talking about. So there's a great article here, Prevent Winter Injuries with Safe Sledding, and a whole series of safety tips associated with having kids sled safely and in safe places and with proper supervision. So this is a great way to reach out. Just write an article like this and offer it to your local newspaper. Offer to send one of your people to a local radio station or TV station to talk about some safe sledding practices. Work with your local pediatric facilities, pediatric care centers, and pediatric nurses and public health departments to reach out and find out what resources they can make available to help support this type of an initiative. Again, it's wintertime, so we're talking about safe sledding, but it could be summertime, and maybe you're listening to this episode 6 months from now, and it's the middle of July. If it's summertime, we should be talking about pool safety and swimming safety and water safety in general. It doesn't matter, but certain times of year mean that certain things are going on in your communities and surroundings. Let's focus on how we can make the public safer. And, you know, maybe you won't have to run that extra call the day when you're just dead tired because you help somebody remember to be safe and they didn't do the thing that would have gotten you on the road. So keep those things in mind and just take a look at this article. It's a great article and you could print it out and post it around your community if you want, just as a way to keep people safe. And some of these ideas are fantastic. Fantastic examples of good prevention techniques. Finally, wrap up with an article here about IV fluids and pre-hospital care. This is from the medicinenet.com site, but it's talking about a recent report on trauma patients and pre-hospital administration of IV fluids and poor outcomes. Trauma patients who receive IV fluids prior to arrival at the hospital have an 11% higher death rate than those who do not. Now, there's a lot of reasons for this, and they even talk about it in the article. Sometimes care and transport is delayed to start an IV. Not appropriate. It's not in my protocols. In fact, it specifically says don't delay transport to start an IV. You know, I'm sorry, if you're a paramedic and you can't start an IV bouncing down the road, you probably don't deserve the name, okay? I think it's one of the things that we do. We're really good at getting IVs started, and so if you need to get an IV on a patient and it's appropriate to do so, you need to do it while you're moving and get them transported. So don't delay transport to start an IV, part one. Part two is we are protocol driven. So if our protocols say we're supposed to administer an IV fluid bolus titrated to a certain blood pressure, and that blood pressure is 100, let's say, 100 systolic, I don't think that blood pressure is probably, I think that's an old number. In my other hat, you know, take the EMS hat off and put the nursing cap on, I can tell you that in the hospital setting, most people, physicians and nurses, not real alarmed until that blood pressure gets down below 80 systolic in certain patient populations and situations. So, yeah, they're monitored and they're keeping track of it, and they're not like ignoring a patient with an extremely low systolic blood pressure, but the studies and the protocols aren't keeping up with the current medical knowledge, and that's one of the problems with broad protocols. You know, if you have a small system and a medical director who changes the protocols a lot, that may not be the case. But I know in places like where I am in Maryland, it's a statewide protocol. You can only change the protocols about once every year because of just the fact of rolling out new protocols it can be problematic. So sometimes we need to, when things stay in the protocols for an extended period of time. I think we need to think outside of the box. We need to look at what's going on with the patient. And one of the things this article points out is patients with penetrating traumatic injury, stab wounds, gunshot wounds, have like 25% greater death rates when pre-hospital fluids are administered. So what are we doing? Well, we're floating the clots. We're increasing blood pressure in a situation where that increased blood pressure increases bleeding. It's a balancing act, and we've got patients that may have died anyway because of the severity of their injuries. So it's hard to tell, But this article does point out that if we're going to be giving IV fluids in the field, we need to do so very carefully, very responsibly. Obviously, we're going to follow our protocols, but I'm going to tell you that if you've taken courses like pre-hospital trauma life support or any of the other trauma courses out there, one of the things they talk about is that we need to lower that systolic minimum. We need to maybe lower it to 90 or even 80 systolic to monitor blood pressure. If a patient is sustaining a blood pressure of 82 systolic and they get down that low, but then they hold it there, that means that the bleeding is at least controlled temporarily. We need an IV established. We need to have fluids going KVO and again, follow your protocols. But I'm just saying that in the hospital setting, that, you know, that type of blood pressure is not an immediate response cause of alarm. It is something that is monitored carefully, but it is not quickly, let's give them 20 cc's per kilogram of fluid. No, we need to be monitoring those patients more carefully. And think about the severity of the wounds. And remember, our protocols are guidelines, but we should be using online medical control to back it up. So if you have a protocol that says 100 systolic, but you have a patient with a penetrating traumatic injury and their blood pressure is low, get the IV started, contact medical control and say, hey, this is what I've got. I'm wondering, do I really want to give them a lot of fluid right now? If the doctor on the other end of the line says, no, you're right, go ahead and hold off, see if you can maintain their blood pressure at 90 systolic and titrate to that blood pressure very carefully, guess what? You may have saved that patient's life, and that's the way we're supposed to be following our protocols. We're supposed to be thinking and critically applying our knowledge. Protocols are there for us to use, but they're not an excuse for us to do something wrong. So keep that in mind and check out this link for this particular article in the news, and I urge you to read this and follow up on the study and understand how what we do and how our protocols work still requires us to be thinking care providers and assessors of our patients. Time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week we're going to be talking about strokes or brain attacks. Why do we call them brain attacks? Well, this has been an initiative that's come about because there's the American Stroke Association and other leaders through the world of medicine have wanted us to think about strokes more like we think about cardiovascular incidents, myocardial infarction. We call them heart attacks. We should call strokes brain attacks, and we should think about them in the same ways. If time is heart muscle, guess what? Time is brain cells too, right? So we need to keep these types of thought processes in mind. And I got an email from a nurse over for the nursing show about stroke and hyperglycemia and understanding some of the long-term aspects of care. And it occurred to me that we haven't done a lot on stroke here on the Medicast or over in the nursing show. So I'm doing a series of programs for both those shows over the next couple of weeks on strokes. And of course, we'll focus here on pre-hospital care, but it is important for us to understand a little bit about the whole continuum of care for strokes because we will be transporting patients between facilities after a stroke, and we'll be having patients with a history of stroke, and we should understand some of the care considerations and implications associated with that. Let's talk about strokes first. We're going to talk about the definitions and causes of strokes. We'll talk about some of the numbers associated with strokes. What are the morbidity and mortality numbers? What's the statistical prevalence of strokes in our communities? We'll discuss signs and symptoms, early recognition and treatment, and also situations, outcomes. And while I call these nursing considerations in this particular video, we can consider these EMS considerations too. What do we want to think about when we have that stroke patient in the back of our ambulance with regard to their long-term outcome? And I think we need to start thinking in that direction more, not just about, all right, we've got a patient, what do we do between here and the hospital? Are there some things we can do to improve them walking out of the hospital at the other end? And that should be our ultimate goal. Strokes or brain attacks, we're talking about sudden loss of blood flow to the brain causing a neurological deficit greater than 24 hours. So it lasts longer than 24 hours. If it lasts less than 24 hours, if that neurological deficit resolves itself, that's considered a TIA or a transient ischemic attack, and it's self-resolving. However, those are ominous because they are often precursors to a full-blown stroke. Those mini strokes usually are pointing to the fact that a bigger stroke is coming because blood clots are breaking off, and eventually a big enough one's going to break free to cause a full-blown stroke. Ischemic strokes, we talked about them briefly. Blood clots causing the stroke. The blood clot gets lodged in an artery feeding blood flow to the brain or a portion of the brain, and that causes that part of the brain to stop receiving oxygen and becomes ischemic. It starts to die. Blood clots cause about 85% of the strokes. So ischemic strokes account for 85%. The other 15% are hemorrhagic strokes. These could be intracerebral or subarachnoid bleeds associated with the vessels that supply blood to the brain. Usually it's an aneurysm that ruptures in the brain, and this can be caused by prolonged hypertension. Untreated hypertension in a patient eventually can cause these aneurysms to form and to indeed rupture if blood pressure continues to remain high. Again, TIAs, transient ischemic attacks, are ominous signs and precursors often of strokes that follow on in the days or weeks following an onset of a TIA. What are some of the stats associated with strokes? Strokes account for 795,000 incidents each year in the United States. Of those, about 600,000 of them are initial strokes. These are patients who have never had a stroke before. So there are a number of patients who still have follow-up strokes. Nearly 200,000 patients have strokes that are their second, third, or fourth strokes. These are preventable, so we need to think about the patients that are having a history of CVA, what's going on with them that may be causing them to have an increased risk for a follow-up stroke. And because we see patients in their homes and in their natural setting, we can certainly sometimes spot things going on in these patients' lives that are putting them at greater risk. Maybe we identify that they're not taking their high blood pressure medication anymore. That's something we need to relay and make sure the nurses are aware of. They usually find out too as they ask the same types of questions we do, but don't assume that. So pass that information along, and maybe they need to have their medications adjusted or a different medication tried because the side effects are causing problems for them. Let's try to get to the bottom of that, and maybe we stave off a call for a stroke on these patients later on. Also, 6 million patients are stroke survivors. So of the 600,000 new strokes each year, over the years, we accumulate this pool of patients that have survived strokes. They're at increased risk for follow-up strokes. They're also, in many cases, up to 70% or up to 30% of them are permanently disabled in some way as a result of their stroke, which causes them to need further health care and support and puts them at risk for other chronic health care issues associated with long-term care. Strokes account for 130,000 deaths each year, and it is the third top cause of death in the U.S. following cardiovascular disease and cancer. Let's talk a little bit about disability because this is really important to understand. Stroke is the leading cause of disability in the U.S. It's significant, and if we can reduce the numbers of people that have long-term effects following a stroke because of rapid recognition, transport, use of stroke centers, and things like that, we can do a lot to return people to work, to their families, and take a lot of stress off the community. Remember, these patients that become disabled end up in long-term care facilities. They end up having other chronic health problems because they're no longer independent and able to care for themselves as well. And we end up transporting them more. So again, rapid treatment and effectiveness can greatly increase and improve how we have long-term issues with having too many transports and too much call volume. We can reduce the numbers of those calls just by being more proactive with handling and treatment of stroke. 20% of the people that have a stroke need long-term care. That's greater than 3 months of rehab and care. So most patients that have a stroke are going to have some level of rehabilitation, and usually that accounts for weeks of rehabilitation after their initial hospitalization. They go to a rehab center, they have follow-up care at home, and that rehabilitation is ongoing. About 20% of those people actually need that care that extends beyond the three-month mark, which becomes long-term care. 30% of them become permanently disabled. Okay, so this is something that this is that reducible number. By rapid recognition, by education of people to recognize stroke and call 911 immediately, we can get people to the hospital to definitive care. And remember, if we can get them in to the hospital, to especially to a dedicated stroke center, activate those stroke resources so that thrombolytics can be applied to the ischemic stroke, we can get rid of that blood clot. And if we can do that fast enough, the patient will have little or no long-term effects from the stroke because of our rapid response and treatment of that patient. And I say our, I mean our whole community, because this starts with that person who recognizes the stroke and calls 911 before we ever get there. What are the costs? Well, this is $73 billion plus every year. That's a lot of money being spent on caring for stroke patients. If we can reduce the incidence of first strokes by reducing preventable risk factors, such as managing high blood pressure in patients, such as reducing the numbers of patients with diseases like cardiovascular disease or diabetes, all of these things can reduce overall healthcare costs associated with stroke. And remember, a lot of those costs are associated with long-term care of patients who now have permanent disability. And this affects everyone. It doesn't just affect us and increasing our call volume. It affects the families of these patients who now have to provide transportation for someone who has lost their license because they can no longer drive following a stroke. Patients and families and communities having to be in long-term care facilities, taking up beds that might otherwise be available for someone else with another problem. All of these things affect everyone in many different ways. And so stroke recognition, prevention, and treatment is a key part of the healthcare system. And we're part of that system, folks. In the EMS sector, we are part of that important system of providing healthcare to our communities. What are some of the stroke signs and symptoms? This is going to be a review for most of you because we review this every time we take CPR research, right? This is part of that system where we're supposed to understand these common signs and symptoms of stroke. So let's recite them together. Sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, especially on one side of the body. Sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding speech. Vision loss or vision disabilities. Sudden trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination, and a sudden severe headache with no known cause. All right, we all know those, but does everybody around us know them? This is one of those things that, heck, you can talk about in the supermarket line. You know, you can offer to go and talk about stroke to a local civic organization, your Rotary Club, your local church groups. Educate people to recognize stroke, to understand that even if it's a stroke that seems to be resolving on its own, a TIA, that person needs to go to the hospital and get checked out right away because they might have another stroke coming anytime. And we need to get them assessed and part into the system as soon as possible to reduce those long-term costs associated with disability. You know, you can use the information, the links I found here. There's a lot of good resources out there. There are PSAs and things like that that will provide you the information you need to support your community. Federal government, National Institutes of Health has some radio spots and video spots that you can put on your local cable or radio stations and educate about stroke. Early recognition is the key. So an early assessment, an effective assessment is the key. Glasgow Coma Score is very important for any type of neurological deficit. So use your GCS and monitor and understand how it works, and then reassess to see if there's any changes. Is the patient getting worse? For stroke, most of us understand or know the Cincinnati Stroke Scale. Let's review that real quick. We have facial droop, arm drift, and speech. So we're going to have that patient grimace and say, "Hey, smile for me. Show me your teeth." Right? You're looking for one side of the face not coming up in tandem with the other side of the face. That facial droop. Arm drift, have them hold their hands out, palm up straight in front of them, their arms out in front, close their eyes, and then watch them while their eyes are closed. And if one of their arms starts to drift downward, that is a sign of one-sided weakness. So they may not even be aware that they're weak on one side, but yet they have this arm drift. So it's something to be aware of. And finally, checking their speech. Have them repeat a common phrase. The one I use, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I say to the person, hey, repeat after me. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. It's that simple. So that's the Cincinnati Stroke Scale. Most of us use it, I think, for assessing stroke patients, but it doesn't hurt to review these kind of things. Finally, treatment. In the EMS sector, that's going to start off with oxygen. Let's keep these patients' head elevated. We don't want to put additional pressure into the cranial cavity, so let's have them sit up in a Fowler's or semi-Fowler's position. These patients are going to be going to get a CT scan, and if they are not having a hemorrhagic stroke, thrombolytics and possibly surgery. So we need to identify the stroke early and then activate the stroke resources in our system. Some of us have dedicated stroke centers to transport patients to now. We need to activate that stroke center so that they have the resources ready to go. And it's kind of like door to balloon time with heart attacks. We need to do the same thing with brain attacks. Door to CT time, door to thrombolytics being on board in these patients will make the difference for full recovery or near full recovery. And we also might want to ID the source of the clot. Maybe this patient's had a recent situation where they've been experiencing other blood clots in their body, maybe blood clots in their legs from recent travel. Maybe it's a recent situation where they've had a pulmonary embolism history in the past. So good history taking of the patient or family members and passing that information along can help narrow down the focus of where these blood clots originated, because obviously we want to get rid of that problem and prevent further strokes from occurring. Tracking outcomes is important, and I'm just going to go over this because some of you may see this information in interfacility transports or in follow-up transports back to the hospital when you're looking at their discharge information or their records. There are various ways that track ongoing treatment and outcomes associated with the severity of the stroke, and I thought it was important to understand some of them. There's the Rankin or modified Rankin scale, the Glasgow Coma or Glasgow Outcome Scale, the Barthel Index, and the National Institutes of Health Stroke Scale. All of these are different scores that are used to determine the severity of the stroke and attempt to be predictive of the long-term outcome for these patients. So if you see them, I thought it's important that you understand exactly what these particular things refer to, and these particular outcome scales are used in different hospital settings. So it might be something you see, and I wanted you to understand, especially those of you that work within a hospital setting or within a hospital system. This is something you might be hearing about during education or, again, reviewing patient records as you transport them. So first off, what do we want to do as a provider? We want to understand scoring and assessment scales. You need to review your Glasgow Coma score if you haven't used it in a while. You also need to make sure you understand how to properly implement the Cincinnati Stroke Scale when you're assessing a patient. So these are all important. Follow your protocols. A lot of these things are in your protocols and are referred to in your protocols, so use what is expected for you to use. Prompt recognition of a stroke and instant action are essential. We need to get oxygen on board these patients. We need to make sure that we're transporting them to an appropriate facility. So if you have a dedicated stroke center and you've identified a stroke, you don't take this patient to the closest hospital. You take them to the closest appropriate hospital. That's the stroke center 10 minutes farther down the road. That's where you go. So make sure you understand that part of your system. Frequent reassessment of the patient is urgent. Just because there's not a whole lot we can do for these patients in the back of an ambulance doesn't mean that we shouldn't be reassessing them regularly to see if there's any changes. Perhaps the stroke is starting to resolve on its own, which is indicative of a TIA. We need to document carefully the signs and symptoms recognized on the scene for this patient, because we need to make sure that the nurses understand, hey, this seems to be resolving, but I did want you to know that this is how bad it was when we got there, and this is how it's changed during the last 20 minutes of our transport. Activate your stroke centers, and then prevention and community and education are key. And this is something we've talked about. I think that we don't do enough in our communities to educate and prevent these preventable problems, whether it's injuries to children, We talked about that in the news segment earlier about common sledding injuries and how to prevent them. We can talk about that, or we can talk about recognizing, preventing, and contacting, activating emergency services for strokes as well. So again, prevention is key. I've got a lot of good resources here for you to follow up on in the show notes, so I urge you to do that, including links to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, which has those radio and TV PSA spots that you can download and get for free, plus a lot of other free or cheap resources from the government that you can make available to your other professionals in your system, as well as for your own in education and edification. Check it out in those resources. And guess what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show, whether you're watching the show or listening to the show. I want to thank you all for checking it out. And make sure you follow up on the additional resources available for you over at medicast.com/blog. You'll find all of the information in the show notes link right at the top of the page. You can click that and you'll find the most recent episode listed first. And you can scroll down and look at past episodes. And of course, if you're watching this, you might want to check out MedicCast TV for other video episodes and short segments here from the MedicCast. If you want to get back in touch with me, of course, you can leave comments on any of the articles over on the MedicCast blog, but you can also get back in touch with me by sending me an email. Send those emails in to podmedic@mac.com and also call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342. 30 Medic. If you want to reach me by Facebook, Twitter, you can do that under the handle PodMedic, twitter.com/PodMedic and facebook.com/PodMedic, and join the over 2,000 fans of the MedicCast over at the Facebook fan page, facebook.com/MedicCast, and then click the like button right there at the top of the page. We're going to go ahead and close out now with our PodSafe song for the week, and this is a song from American Heartbreak. It's a song called The Last of the Superheroes of the 1970s. If you like what you hear, you can check out their song in the show notes link and let them know you heard it here on the MedicCast. There's even a link to find their songs over in iTunes. So check out their music over there. And hey, you know, buy one of their songs if you like them and show their support, show your support for them providing their music here to shows like the MedicCast. That's it. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back again next week to bring you another episode of the MedicCast to kick off your week as an EMS professional. In the meantime, please remember, scene safety, BSI. We've seen them on TV our whole life. Super friends were the Rolling Stones, were larger than life. I can be like anyone I see on a record album sleeve. Pistols and the Who, Dolls and Ramones, Don Kirshner on TV. Seventies.